Hi, I'm Hannah.
And I'm Kira.
This is a BBC Sherlock podcast, where we are doing a Watsonian analysis of the show, series 1 through 4.
Whether you're initiated, a veteran fan, or just wondering why series 4 was like that, we have you covered.
Listen to our discussion as we play the great game. All right, hello, welcome to the Chancellor Chess BBC Sherlock podcast. I'm Hannah.
I'm Kira.
And today we're going to talk to you about why we're making this podcast and what you're listening for. First, I'd like to throw out a welcome to all of our TJLC friends out there. And if you are not familiar with TJLC, we will explain that in a bit. But this podcast, to those who are unacquainted, we are just two friends that want to talk about BBC Sherlock because we love it a lot. And we are going to talk to you about our theories about the show, what we love about it so much, and what we think about Series 4. So do we want to first explain what TJLC is, or do you want to talk a little bit about other stuff first?
I don't know. Yeah, I guess we could we could talk about what TJLC is. I think it'd be a great primer for this.
TJLC is an acronym. And before I say what it is, part of it is a little bit of a joke. So if you've never heard about us before, don't take it as like a take it too seriously.
It's not
it's meant
serious.
It was a self-aware joke. So TJLC stands for the John Locke, JL, John Locke conspiracy. And so it's not really a conspiracy. We don't think anyone's doing anything nefarious or whatever. It's mostly just,
it's media analysis. Yeah, it's a media analysis that was originally, like, the term was coined in 2014, and it just kind of, it came as a joke, and it just, like, we just ran with it, you know.
Yeah, because they were like, okay, this is what we think. Originally, it started off as like John Locke's go. And then shortly after, I think one of the next few posts, right, was someone being like, it's so crazy. People are going to think it's like this wild conspiracy, even though it's really just what's in the text is what we're just describing.
It was something like that. I think it was kind of more like, I think it was like a separate thing. From my understanding, there was a few people who sort of had the same like feelings about like the sign of three specifically, and it was kind of like, well, what if John Locke really is happening, and if it is happening, they'd have to have been lying about it, and like yada yada conspiracy.
And then shortly after that, we were all like, no, it's not like really a conspiracy, because it's not anything that it's not a conspiracy, because this conspiracy is something that they're doing to cover up something else, and they're not really covering it up. It's, you know,
I mean, it's a TV show, and I think it's makes sense that that writers of a TV show might withhold like the future plots.
Just makes sense, right? Like, why would you spoil anything?
Yeah, that makes sense. It's like, that's literally all we're saying. And you know, even with that, like we don't know. We're not going to purport to know the future or anything like that. But
no, I think even this whole podcast, we're going to really get into a lot of our theories about the show just in general. So it's not going to be limited to TJLC, but that is always going to be a part that's connected to it. And it really shapes our full understanding of like the reasons why they're doing what they're doing and why things are the way they are. But it's not going to be limited to just that. So I'm of the belief that a lot of what we're going to be talking about when it comes to series 4 specifically is, and like our theories about certain characters are going to be, I think they can stand up on their own and they're not limited to TJLC or John Locke in general, but without that, I think it kind of cuts it off at its knees, but it can still stand on its own. So it really just provides our theory as to why, the reasonings for why they're doing what they're doing with the show. But we'll get into all of that. I think kind of going off of the conspiracy bit is I think a lot of criticism people get for that, at least they used to, and they probably would still too, is like, why would they make it a quote unquote conspiracy? Why would they try to withhold this? Why wouldn't they just do it? Right? Why wouldn't they, if they wanted to make their characters gay, why wouldn't they just have them be that way? Why do they have to reveal it like it's some special thing? And I think that's going to be probably our first point that we're going to talk about throughout this whole podcast, is why would they need to go to such lengths to sort of reveal it? It's not really something that's being revealed, but I think the fact that they have to reveal it like it's this big secret and needs to be coded and deciphered and all that kind of points to the reality that it had to be in the first place, and also the way that they're doing it and the way that they want to see queer media in the future as like something that's pretty natural in the story is something that I think, if not this show, someone is going to have to do something similar. At least that's my understanding, where
I also think to a degree it's more than, you know, just being about like revolutionary representation. It's also really important to the Sherlock Holmes canon. It's doing much more than creating these revolutionary gay characters.
Yeah, it's doing a lot of stuff. Yeah, I think it's definitely both. They're definitely inextricable. They can't really separate the two ideas. I think it's just that second part is just like there because it has to be. I think the primary focus for why they do what they do is always like because of the canon from the characters and the show and the original stories, and that's why they do what they do, and everything else is kind of just a bonus.
Yeah, and I also think Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss are just, they just love subtext anyway. It's just fun, you know? There's that whole thing. It's just really fun.
Yeah, the subtext is fun, and I think they like mystery stories. They love...
It's a puzzle. Yeah, it's a puzzle. It's like a puzzle for people to solve. And you see this in a lot of their work. You know, it's not something new. You know, as much as, you know, we can criticize Dracula, they definitely do that in Dracula. It's just kind of their modus operandi. Like,
yeah, and I don't think it's... I think some people take offense to it. Like, it's the superiority thing. Like, they're so clever, they just have to show off and or whatever. Or, like, we can come across that way, but I think it's just... it's not meant to like show people, haha, you missed it. We're so smart. Here's the secret thing that we've been hiding. And like this contest, like, well, we're so much smarter and special because we caught on. But really, it's just has nothing to do with that. I think it's really just a particular way of telling a story and a particular way of telling a Sherlock Holmes story that just appeals to certain people, and that's why they made it, because they're just making it for themselves, and it just so happens that we like what they are doing.
We're the yeah, people that they're exactly. making it for.
Yeah.
Like, we're like the audience. Like that joke that we have, it's like they make a show for five people and we're the five people. Yeah. And themselves.
Yeah, we're that special five people. Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. I think they're ultimately making it for themselves, trusting that other people will similar to them, like if they like it, there will be other people that will also like it and pick up on it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about ourselves and like our relationship to the show. I think just the people know who we are a little bit. We're both bloggers on the Tumblr.com.
That was great.
Special place. a place to be. Not that I would recommend getting into it.
Yes. We're just here because we've just been here. So, like, where else are we going to go?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I don't really know of any other community where we are able to talk about this show and our similar theories to any length. We've got a good Discord, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
It's not.
No, it's not.
But anyway, we both met online there. We both have a blog. We talked about it. We started talking, I think, right. Was it before series 4 or was it right after? No, it was before.
I think it was right before series 4. Yeah,
I remember, I think it was probably for a very brief time because I didn't get into TGLC specifically until, I want to say like summer 2016. So pretty
Wow,
close
what a
before.
time to
I
come.
know. Well, I think it was I just kind of caught wind of the post the Abominable Bride episode theories, and I caught wind of that. For me, it was some YouTube channel, like I think it was Are They Gay? We're talking about Rebecca at the time, Rebecca Reb's channel, and that's how it got mentioned. And then they were talking about the Abominable Bride, and I hadn't seen that episode. I'd seen the whole show except that one special. I had kind of tuned out of the show for a while, and so I got spoiled for it, but I didn't really care. So that's how I like, oh, I didn't know they did that. Oh, wow. And then I tuned in, and then it took not very long for me to get sort of convinced, and that's when I jumped into it. But you were around a lot longer, right?
Yeah, I got into it like the end of 2014. So and this was the first time I watched the show. I watched the show in like I'm gonna say like November or October of 2014. And soon thereafter, like I went straight to Tumblr and I just like I don't know, I was just searching for like stuff because I was like trying to make sense of the show and I kept seeing like this like hashtag TJLC, and I was like, what the fuck is that? So I just started looking at that, and then I found Loudest Subtext and Television's first meta Operation John Locke's Go, and I was just like,
Nice.
holy shit. And I just like
Whoa.
went on this like
And that was before
binge.
his last vow, too.
Yes, actually, yeah, well, yeah, when she wrote that, yes, but by
Yeah,
the
it's
time like
wild, right?
season three was already out, but I was like, holy shit. And I like remember just being like I just like feeling all of the feelings.
Was that right before Tab? That was
Sort
like
of. It was
January
no, it was right
2014.
before Tab was filmed. So
Oh,
it
okay.
like it
Oh,
wasn't even filmed yet. They were
ooh. Oh, that's right. It came out in 2016.
yeah.
Yes. Okay.
And
Okay.
Yeah, I remember reading that and just yeah, losing my mind. And because I remember like when I was getting into the show, like I knew John Locke, like the ship existed, right? Because you know it was on the internet. I remember a lot of people like having discourse about it, and I was under the impression that it was like nothing, or that like it was just like oh, just jokes or something, and then like.
Oh, like the typical at the time, not so out of the blue, like gay joke that they just
Yeah,
kind of
that it
got
was
away
like, I
with.
guess, queer baiting, you know, in the very traditional sense of it just being like just jokes, not being serious in the narrative whatsoever. And like
Yeah,
I
same.
remember like being under the impression because I saw like GIFs and people talking about it that oh, John gets married to a woman, and I thought Charlotte got married to a woman because I saw
Oh
the like gifs of him proposing to Janine before I even saw the show. So I was just like, oh, they both get married, so it's no. And yeah, I remember watching it just slowly like having these little moments where I'm like, wait, what? That was not a joke. And just not being able to like make sense of that in my
Yeah.
brain.
But you did you think like or see something as potentially being read a certain way? At the time, like with certain goggles on. Because at the time I watched it, I don't think, like the first time I watched it, I wasn't aware of, I don't think I even knew what subtext was. It just wasn't in my vocabulary. I wasn't taught
Oh yeah, I didn't either. I was dumb
that.
as sh like I
I
just
don't think I was dumb. I was just young, and I just wasn't taught that formally in my English classes. Like we would talk about like symbolism, but the idea of subtext and what it really is and how it works and all that, it just wasn't part of my understanding. And it wasn't until I got into Supernatural that I learned that way, because that was more accessible to me at the time. And I don't know, maybe I just got more into it, or I followed certain people and it just sort of was easier. And so the first time I watched it before, I learned more, and then I re learned more, and then rewatched later and had a different experience. For the first time I watched it, a lot of people report being very confused or pointing to the end of the sign of three. But I was a little confused, like, okay, well, why is he still sad? Like, I knew he was going to be sad, but I thought, like, that was the point of the episode, and it was resolved. But he's still sad? Why is he leaving? I don't get it. But I didn't stop to think about it for too long. It didn't put any questions in my mind, but it was definitely made me pause and get confused. And then, just as a general audience viewer with heteronormative goggles on, I just didn't make sense to me. And then I think his last vow, I didn't like the ending because I didn't get it at the time, like with certain goggles on. I think I was a little bit aware of the ship because I do remember watching his last vow and getting to the end and being like, what? Wait a minute. Wait, what is he going to say?
He's not going to actually say that, is he?
And then he didn't. And so then I immediately reverted back to you. Never mind, it's all straight. Okay, well, they're friends. So why are they ending it like this? It just didn't make sense. If you were looking at it as them being friends, it just didn't compute in my brain. Why are they leaving it this way? Just a handshake? Like, I think if they were more, if they were actually just friends, or if there wasn't a tension there, I think there would have just more security and just like giving your bro a hug. Because, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There definitely could have been. But they gave it so much like weight.
I know.
It was just like he couldn't even shake his hand. Like, it was just like that moment where he's just like putting his hand out, and then John's just like.
And I was confused by that. I think that's what I meant earlier. I was confused, but I was mostly just annoyed and mad. Like, ugh, why is his character reverting back to this? Like, really? I thought we moved past that. Like, it just did not make sense. I guess, like, in the terms of character growth, but with a different perspective, it would make total sense. But anyway, not to go on to this for too long, because we will definitely get to all of that later. So I thought we would talk about why we love the show, or why we love the characters so much. I think it's really hard for me to pinpoint what it is about John. I don't know why. I think I honestly didn't. I loved both of them mostly. And I think I used to like Sherlock a little bit more, or related to him a little bit more. And then it wasn't until series four that I became much more understanding of John Watson's character. Is it the same for you, or is it totally different?
Sort of. Because I think when you first view it, if you're like, you don't know how to interpret media. Because, I mean, when I first watched it, I didn't know anything about interpreting media. Like, I knew nothing. You know, you're immediately, the show kind of tricks you to, like, care more about the most interesting character, the seemingly most, like, interesting, flamboyant character. But John is sort of like this quiet sort of,
he's the quote-unquote everyman, which Martin Freeman has done similar roles to, but but there's always a actual complexity. So I don't think he would agree that they're actually everyman characters, but...
Oh, yeah, he doesn't. He doesn't agree. No. He said before he doesn't think... He, like, rejects this idea that John Watson is, like, ordinary and boring.
But you can understand why people would come to that conclusion, because they're not really looking. They're just... They kind of accept things at face value, with especially with his character. And I was still very young when I started watching the show, so I think I was just subject to that, too. And I wasn't really looking super closely.
I wasn't. I had no excuse.
No. I was like, I mean, I don't know. I was in high school. I didn't really get it. I mean, I still liked him. I'm sure I could have pointed to things and that were complex about his character, et cetera. But it's so much easier to be, you know. So I do love John Watson, though. I think with series four, it gave me a whole new appreciation for his character. And it really shines a different light that's easier to notice when you understand series four and then look back at the first three seasons. You see the root of all of that.
Absolutely. Character development. Yeah, I think John has, like, he's like this very quietly complex character. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, the complexity comes in, like, the way that he presents himself. Yes. He's sort of like his ordinariness is like is a mask. It's a shield. You know, he's
Yes. And it's a total, like, it's like what makes the two main characters the same, but also complete opposites. They are like yin and yang that way, where they both are kind of the same person, but the way that they deal with it and the front, the facade that they put on is what's like opposite.
Because Sherlock sort of, and I remember someone made a post about this where it was like, they were talking about how Sherlock and John both represent the two different ways that queer people tend to like deal with alienation. You have John who he is alienated from the world because he's trying so hard to fit in and be normal. And Sherlock is so much himself that he pushes people away.
Yeah, like his entire like intellect and personality is just, it would be almost impossible for him to hide it. So he just never bothered because he was just always different anyway and for different reasons. But John, I think, which is why I really relate to him, he is pretty much normal, quote unquote, ordinary in a lot of ways. Like if you're just looking at it from a surface level, which is why we see him as an everyman character. But you really don't have to dig very far to see that he's actually not, and that's why he's even friends.
Yeah,
with
I mean,
Sherlock
you can see it in the first episode. Like, he has no friends. He's like rude to everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, no one notices that. They think he's like the normal one that humanizes Sherlock. No. And he's literally like, he has no friends. Nobody likes him. And like the way he like yells at Mrs. Hudson, and like the way he's just like really terse with this Stamford.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that is it's really easy to put it on like, oh, he's just going through it. He's just sad and depressed and traumatized, PTSD. And then you kind of put it under the rug because you understand it. And so you just kind of, you mm-hmm. don't really question it too much, how much of that is actually his personality. Because you don't know him very well yet. You haven't seen him for a long period of time. So, and so that maybe is a good segue because I do really love, I relate to John the most, but I think I still do relate to Sherlock a lot because I think even though I'm not as smart as him, I'm not as outwardly strange, he's very like, I don't know, other people interpret him as being OCD. I don't know if you...
Yeah, I mean a little bit. I interpret him as being on the spectrum.
Definitely ADHD. Yes, that too. I think there's a lot of neurodivergence that you could read all of them into his character. I think the show really makes it pretty plain that they, I think, or at least John made a line or something about him being...
Him having Asperger's, yeah.
Which very well.
I don't know. ICS. I don't know if they take that seriously.
I don't know either,
I think to me it seems like just from the people that I know who have autism, he seems like somebody who has autism.
Yeah. And I think there's definitely a reading that could be made as well of him being ADHD too, which there's just like a general neurodivergence about him that's separate from his intelligence that I think is very relatable. So.
Oh, yeah, same. Yeah, I would say, like, I relate to both of them in, like, sort of different ways.
Different ways, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I relate to Sherlock in that way. I feel like sometimes I can be kind of closed off to people, like, on purpose in that way.
I don't think that's the way that I relate to him, but I think I relate a little bit more to John in that way, where I put on this a veil of like normalcy and ordinary, like don't look too close, and the things that are weird or out there, like I just don't, I'm not open about it, whereas I think Sherlock would be the complete opposite.
Yeah, I'm kind of both with the same thing too. I feel like I can sometimes come across as ordinary as well, but yeah, I don't know, there are bits and pieces.
Okay, I do think it's really funny that so many of fans of the show are all, there's like a running joke that we're all just ADHD.
Yeah, I know. I just assume everyone has it, and sometimes I'll be talking to someone, I'm like, oh yeah, it's your ADHD, and they're like, I don't have ADHD.
I know. There's like that one random person in our group of our circle where they'll say something, I'm like, oh yeah, this person,
like, oh yeah, you don't have ADHD,
get it?
Oh yeah,
I don't do that. They probably feel like the weird one out, but really they're just doing things normally, so that's what it's like. Okay, Let's jump into why we wanted to make this podcast in the first place, because I think other people on the outside are wondering, maybe who've heard of us, or like, why are you making this now? Or why are you doing this at all? Like, we don't
It's post series four. Like, aren't you gone yet?
Yeah, right? Like, didn't they, the people who are criticizing you, like, kill you off?
I know, like, didn't they just eradicate you? Like, didn't you just disappear?
Right, didn't all your theories and knowledge just wither and die in series four? No.
No, we're still here, I'm sorry.
And that's what we're going to clear up. Nope, we're still here, sorry. But I think that's one thing that, there's a lot of reasons why. I think the main reason is we love to talk about it. We love to talk about the show. We can't get enough of it. But also there's a void there that I think could be filled. And I don't think either of us were really wanting to make a YouTube channel. That was like before series four. And now this is the after. But I think that's just not what we wanted to do. I think this is more long form and more personal too. And that was one thing was important to me, is I think a lot of people don't know that we're here because we for a long time didn't talk about it much, or they just don't follow us, so they don't know, or they don't read our posts, so they don't see who we really are as people and what we really think. And I think this is just a good way to talk about the show, where TGLC isn't necessarily the main focus. It's definitely front and center, but not the whole thing. So I think people can still get something out of our theories, and if they're open, they can just listen to us and decide for themselves.
Yeah, we're just like people who, you know, have a theory about a show, and we're having fun, and we're not hurting anybody, and we're very different than how we used to be, and just to show you what we're all about, and that, you know, we still exist.
Mm-hmm. I think people definitely have an idea of TGLC, quote unquote, as a particular image, when we weren't even really prominent. Mm-mm. At all.
I was not at all. I was a lurker for most of the time. So
yeah, and you were around more than me, and I was only around for like, what, 6 months, and I would make the occasional post, and I talked to like two people, maybe three. Like, most people I followed, but it wasn't until after that there was an opening
for us.
That's when I started. I think that's when I started posting the most anyway.
Oh yeah, you definitely did.
I didn't feel like I was adding. I wasn't adding to anything before. It was just like, oh, I agree.
We all kind of, I think, like, after series four, most of us were just sort of like adding, like, we're just like showing, just showing screenshots of the show and be like, look at it.
Yeah. I meant before. So before series four.
Oh, right.
I wasn't really adding. I wouldn't have added it because we were just kind of like sitting and waiting at that point.
Yeah. The only thing I added was art. I added artwork to the fanzine that we did
before
series four. So I have a piece in there. That's like all I contributed prior to series four.
Yeah, I've got nothing. I think I had one post that got a decent amount of notes, but it was before the final problem. So it was mid season four. And then it wasn't until after that I became more active. So we're definitely a new, quote, I guess, a new age. I mean, a lot of people are still around, but...
Oh, yeah. A lot of people are still around, but there's definitely, like, the makeup has shifted. It's very different.
Mm-hmm.
The attitudes, I think, are very different. It's a different culture than it used to be.
And there's definitely not a divide. I won't use that word, but it's there's a variety of experiences in how people processed the season. So some people have always been around, and then people took to different... ways of processing it.
A lot
and
of people left because they just
yeah, and a lot of people interpret it, and a lot of people interpreted it differently too. So, not everyone is as staunchly like block theory or whatever else, et cetera, as we are. And I think a lot of people missed it.
There seems to be two major like parties within TGLC currently, and that's block theory, and then there's EMP. I don't know that there's any.
I don't know how big. I don't know. Yeah. Well, I think I look at it as there's people that are still TGLC, but aren't necessarily. There might be blog theory, but aren't like they buy into it. Like, I was talking to someone the other day about it, and they were clued into theories, but then just sort of checked out before, and then never read a lot of the foundational meta that we were talking about, like Amy's stuff from like mid 2017. Just didn't, we're so checked out by like, and burnt out from post series four drama and theories that they just checked out and didn't hear about it until much later.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course people go off and get new interests. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of different. I mean, that's expected. There are some people that just like,
yeah,
weren't really sure how to feel about series four and just mm-hmm. kind of like, just weren't really feeling it anymore. And I get yeah. that. Like there are some people that, but I think when it comes to just like, what are the post series four theories? Like it's either like blog theory or it's AMP. And then like, yeah. But if like there are people in between who don't know what to think.
Yes. And then there's people on the outside that have just fought, that maybe totally checked out or were never in it in the first place, but maybe kind of kept an eye on it. So I think a lot of people still point to, I would be surprised if anyone that's not clued in had any idea what blog theory even really is.
Yeah.
Let alone all the other wealth of discoveries that we have all discussed to death in our echo chamber.
Yeah.
Yep. Which it's not an echo chamber necessarily. I think it's not an intentional or even like a voluntarily we're letting it become that way. It's just no one really wants to engage with us. And I think that's what stands out is different from how people might view us. In a negative way, where we actually would love to engage in a dialogue with people and are willing to, but they just don't really want to hear us.
Yeah, no, it's kind of seems like people want to have a dialogue about us without our consent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which I hope this could get some people's attention. But if you are listening and don't like us, I would politely request not to be talked about without also engaging in a dialogue back and forth rather than being talked about.
Yeah. It really sucks.
It's like you have the right to, but also it would be nice.
Yeah. I mean, just think about it, you know, just like try to see us as people and hear us out if you want to.
Yeah. There's definitely an element of cringe culture that hasn't died off.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, so I think that's really why we want to make the podcast and to show people who know who we are that we're still here and we're just normal people wanting to have fun. And that's really what we're doing this for, so that we, too, can chat about all of our theories. But we will not be totally excluding other people, though. So we will try our best to make it accessible, and so that's why we're going to explain things without it being like a pitch, like here's why you should believe us. It's more, if you are open to hearing our theories, here's what we think, without it being like a formal essay or anything.
Absolutely.
Yeah, do our best. So so yeah, and if you're outside of it, we will do our best to walk through it in a way that is accessible and won't exclude anyone or be super confused. But if you still have questions after an episode or two, like, I don't know if I totally agree or disagree, there's so many things to talk about that support our theories that we can't possibly do it in
one setting episode. Or yeah, absolutely. No. There's so much information. Okay, it's like ridiculous. So I have a whole encyclopedia in my head from this.
Yes. Sometimes the things that I don't even realize are there. Like, we were off air, I think we were talking about like, oh, I just remembered this one part or this one scene or piece of music or whatever. And I'm like, oh my goodness.
I know, like coming to like new conclusions. I'm like, I think I found like a completely new conclusion that I haven't thought about. And it's crazy.
Yes, for sure. I wish I had that experience just a week ago or so, maybe a little bit more. And I think, some distance too is what's fun about this, is that we're starting to get back into it and revive the discussion because we all sort of collectively took a break where we wouldn't really talk about it in any depth for a long time, and only in like random spurts would be just repeating the same thing.
But it's been like 4 or 5 years. I mean, like, we can't talk about it forever. There comes a moment in time where I'm like, okay, I've exhausted I've exhausted everything and I need something else. But it's nice to compare.
Yes, which is kind of part of, not, it's not that we're creating it, but it's anything that requires thought or creation or a unique perspective, you have to step away from it for a while anyway. So I think it's just a natural thing,
mm-hmm.
but it kind of worked out in our favor that we all just sort of went out, got our thoughts out, came to a somewhat satisfying conclusion to tide us over. Mid-2017, 2018 is where we had the bulk of our theories, and then we all just sort of tapered off slowly as we got interested in new things. But this is, I think it's been long enough time, and I'm not quite as busy anymore, that I can sit down and re-engage. So I think we'll come up with some new insights as we go along, so it'll be fun. And let's see, if you are interested in the show or this theory, you were into TGLC or you're not at all or whichever, however you fall, are the main point that we're getting into with this, our goal is to share what we think. And the point that's important to know is that we firmly believe that the show isn't over. We're not just, you know, doing this for no reason. We think that there's something there and there's more to expect, more to come, because we know that there's a series five. There's been no evidence to firmly suggest like they're never doing another season.
Yeah.
It's just another hiatus. That's just a unique one, but
a really long one. Hiatus.
Yes. Very long one with unique circumstances. And I think people just assumed it was over because the episode felt like it was over. Things aren't necessarily always what they seem. And I think in interviews, early interviews, shortly after the episode, Stephen Moffat, I can't remember the exact quote, but I know he was talking about it and the interviewer was like implying that it was over and that was a finale. And he was like, no. That wasn't it. That wasn't, not necessarily. And I think Mark was like, oh, it feels like a finale, but just because it feels like a finale doesn't mean it is a finale. They've never said we're never doing anything except a random special.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what they've been saying. And even Martin Freeman said it, you know, like it seems like an ending. It sure seems like an, like every interview they say that it sure seems like an ending, which is a weird thing to say if it's supposed
to be an ending. But they haven't come, because they've never said this is it. This is the end. Otherwise, I think they would have. From a marketing standpoint, it would be logical to say that this is the final season.
And I think it's important to note that them saying it seems like an ending is really a pivotal, important part of the thematic analysis of the show, specifically with the final problem. And we'll get into that at some point. But I love how they, in interviews and like they keep going with it. You know, like they go with the theme in interviews.
Yeah. Whereas before, I think they just go with the way things seem, literally. Like they wait for people to have what they assume and then they go with it. They're not like outright saying, this is what you should think. They're just saying, kind of going along with it. Because if people are thinking that it's a finale, they're not going to tell them it's not, but they're not going to say that it is. They're just going to let people think what they think because they're going to anyway. But then you go back to interviews before series four and they said that they planned, I don't know if they definitively planned out a 5-season arc. I think they might've.
They said they did. Yeah. They said that at multiple points. They said it in the beginning, like when they first were making the series, they're like, oh, we have a 5-series arc.
There was an interview or a quote from Moffat where he said, that it wasn't explicitly Sherlock, but it might have been, where he talked about like, oh yeah, and I've got a 5-season show that I want to pitch to you or whatever it was he said. Yeah. And then, but we do know, something
but
like
has,
that.
But he has said that about...
Yes, they have said... Mark,
they have said it about Sherlock. And they've also said it like when they were making series 3, they were like, oh, we planned out all of series 4 and 5. And then there's also another quote of them right before filming Tab.
Yeah, I think that was while they were working on Yes, yep. While they were working on that they had sat in.
Yeah, they were like, well, how are people going to feel after they see series 4? And they're like desperate for series 5. And then
Yes.
it, yeah, and it goes as soon, as recent as right before the airing of series 4, where they said that they had the idea of series 5 on a post-it note.
Yes. Or maybe
So,
I'm lying.
or maybe I'm
Yeah, and
lying.
they planned out, they sat in a camper or an RV or whatever, a trailer, and they planned out series 4 and 5. So they knew a general direction of where they were going for a fifth season before they sat down to actually write series 4. And I do think it's very funny that they said desperate for series 5 because we're desperate, but the general audience isn't.
Yeah, we're the only
Right. Everyone else, when they hear about Series 5, they're gonna be like,
ones, though. Everyone's like, we don't want to
another
know.
one? Ugh, I thought they were gone.
Except for the people in except for the people in Stephen Moffat's Instagram comments, they're desperate for it. So, I mean, I think maybe more people are desperate
I
for it.
think there's definitely certain camps that are like, don't want it, and others that are there, because there were a lot of people that like, totally outside of the fan bases completely, and then hated it completely or loved it. So
Yeah, I think there are normies that still would still want more. So,
I wouldn't say they would be desperate though, because I think for some people the end of series 4 would feel like somewhat satisfied, but who knows? I don't know.
I don't understand how you could find that satisfying if you view it.
I don't either, but hey, that's a conversation for another day. All right, let's talk about how we view series 4 very, very, very briefly. Like why we're talking, because I think a lot of people would not even be super into it as we are and still like it was awful or like I thought you guys were all or like I thought you guys were all mad about that. Like, I don't get it. It's so bad, or, a million different things people could say about it. And there were some critics that had bad things to say about it too. Like there were general audiences that liked it, and I remember reading reviews that didn't, or critics didn't like it at all. And I think some people are just like baffled as to why we're so passionate about it. And that's what we're getting into. So the reason why you could look at series 4 and not and why we would think that, oh, it's not over and there's actually another interpretation. I think people would at the outset start to get very nervous or weary or suspicious of us and would start to roll their eyes maybe if we started to say, oh, series 4 is fake, which we did say at the beginning, but that puts people off. And so what we want to start out with, I think this is kind of what you talked about in your the essay that you wrote for school was that there's a way to talk about this without making that shows that there is some basis in not only logic and reasoning and reality, but there's a historical basis for what we're talking about here. That's not even exclusive to TGLC. There's a whole different reading that I think anyone could be open to, no matter what. That is the idea of playing the game, or the Sherlockian game, however you want to call it, or the great game, as we refer to it. So, how did do you want to give some of your thoughts as to why that was your idea to lead us into explaining the great game to people as like the way to explain series 4?
I think, all right, so I'm gonna have to like, how do I start this off? Because I feel like there's so many parts to it. But the great game, I
For
guess we could
sure.
go over what the great game is. So the great game, or the Sherlockian game, or the other name of it, whatever. It's the great game or the Sherlockian game.
The game. I think it's just the game, I think.
Or the game, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a Holmesian tradition dating back to the early
Yes.
1900s, which was started by this guy named Ronald Knox. And it's basically this idea that fans of the Sherlock Holmes books were coming up with all these theories about like viewing Watson as an unreliable narrator and trying to figure out like the truth. What was Watson hiding? because in the original books, Watson is like the way that they're written, because he is an unreliable narrator. It's written first person past tense, as if the stories are being published in a magazine.
Which they were. So it's very meta.
Yeah, it's very meta. And he would oftentimes admit that he would leave out certain details, that he might change the names and dates of things. And so fans took this as like an excuse to like, okay, well, what's the truth? Let's look at the subtext. Let's look at everything in the books and try to figure out what really happened.
The essay that he wrote, he pulls out, he started the tradition of like really looking into it, that's my understanding of it, because it's definitely satire, because he's making up all these names of scholars, quote unquote, that are picking apart and having certain views of it, so that he, the author of the essay, can go through the different ways of reading the stories and looking at things that were popular to pick apart. And I think people do this even now. They look at tiny little plot holes and inconsistencies and they hold on to that, which is coincidentally part of the reason why I don't buy into EMP theory, just because of something that we all kind of within our group, we tend to agree on it. And there's a quote that he wrote where he said, two inaccuracies are too slight to form the basis for so elaborate a theory. Because he was talking about where people would point to like a different color robe or I don't know, someone, he was here when they were actually there at this date, or they couldn't have solved this because of it wasn't possible, or this certain thing wasn't made until blah, blah, blah. Like the tires of the bicycle, you actually couldn't tell from whatever. So people pointed to really specific details. And there's even still a tradition of like, how many wives did Watson have? Whatever else.
I know there's so much of that. I think that was definitely like an over analyzation of something that has a much simpler explanation. Yeah. And it's something that people do. And that's like, it's very Sherlockian to just go into detail, yes, and go overboard.
Which the details can add a cushion to a theory and support it, but you can't go from details and then build from there. You have to look at the big picture, which, mm-hmm, I think he in his essay was looking at. Like, what are the facts? What are the big picture things that you can't explain without, and you have to work your way backwards. And I think that's our view of the show as well, specifically series 4, where we've got some emotional distance. Now, how can we look at it from a somewhat more objective perspective? And you're looking at the big picture, mm-hmm, and that's really what we're trying to do. And then all the other things that originally when we would talk about TGLC, we would point to like moments between characters. And if you're not willing to buy that, then you're not willing to, if you're leading with that, I think people aren't willing to get the big picture stuff. Like, that's a big theory you're positing is possibly true, and it just feels unbelievable. But when you start from the outside and work your way down, I think it has a different way of softly bringing people to a certain conclusion, or at least potentially, anyway. The essay itself sparked a tradition of Sherlockian studies, but not just like it sparked a lot of scholarship around the stories, and it's a tradition ever since then to look at the stories from a Watsonian perspective. And if you don't know what that is, it's just Watson as the author. And so explaining certain things or confusion or inconsistencies or a possibility of something being falsely written as what is the in-story reason as to why. Granted, there are some things that where the Doyleist perspective comes in, where you can point to it and probably say, well, he just forgot. Or he just made a mistake.
Yeah, he just forgot Mrs. Hudson's name, so he called it.
Which happens, right? Like, anyone could make that mistake. So it's really looking at the things that are more prominent and significant, that are, even within a story, too obviously intentional. or potentially anyway, where Watson would say something within the story, like that he's like going to, I have some quotes I can pull up and look at. So there's the one from the one we loved to refer to is the Adventure of the Three Students, where it's just at the beginning where he says, it was the year 95 that a combination of events into which I need not enter. So he will posit something is a thing that has happened behind the scenes where he's telling you that I'm a writer telling you the story, but these are things I'm just not going to tell you. And then the more famous one, or at least the most relevant anyway, is where he says in The Adventure of Charles Augustus Milverton, it is years since the incidents of which I speak took place, and yet it is with diffidence that I allude to them. For a long time, even with the utmost discretion and reticence, it would have been impossible to make the facts public. But now the principal person concerned is beyond the reach of human law, and with due suppression, the story may be told in such a fashion, etc., etc. The reader will excuse me if I conceal the date or any other fact by which he might trace the actual occurrence. So there's very specific words, alluding, discretion, reticence, suppression, and like literally saying, excuse me if I am blatantly lying to you about something, because there's reasons why I have to lie. I can't tell you literally everything. So he is telling us that some things are, there's an implication that very well, it invites you to look closely to know, well, what are they hiding? And it could be more than just a simple name or date. It could be more than that. And the writer's view on that, like now, so Moffat and Mark Gatiss said in an interview a long time ago, which I can link as well in a description of an episode. So I definitely recommend reading the whole thing. But they said, if you read that the same story, Dr. Watson in the opening paragraph tells you that he's about to tell you a porky. He says, I even now must be very reticent. I think what Doyle is hinting at is that Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson sat in Baker Street and said, right, we are going to have to go and kill him, aren't we? That's the only way we can do this. So they break in, kill him, and then Dr. Watson writes up a story of this version of the story that puts the murder on someone else. Because when you really look at the story, you realize looking back at the beginning, you don't think much of what he's saying. Like, I'm concealing something from you, because you haven't read the whole story yet. You have to really go through the whole thing to look at it in potentially a different light. So that's one example of him blatantly saying that he's not telling you the whole truth. And so some people like to look at the original canon as the final problem is totally fake, it was made up, or the return stories after that were totally made up, and or they didn't happen the way that they come across as. And there's a couple reasons for that. So anything you want to add before we go into maybe some examples?
There's some stuff I do want to say, but I don't want to veer too much into like discussing series four. But I will say a lot of series four, I believe, is based off of the later stories. There's a lot to that. Like, there's a reason why they are the way they are, and it is sort of hearkening back to all of canon. It's sort of like going through the great game, the subtext of the canon. And there's a lot of references to the later stories. Specifically, I guess something I just want to mention really quickly and not go too much into it, but so not only is the Six Thatchers the name of a case that they already solved in season two, that you can see it's on the blog and it's on screen in A Scandal in Belgravia. Yes. It's the same name, but it's a different case. In the later stories, the Speckled Ban and the Lion's Mane. So the Lion's Mane was in the later stories. The Lion's Mane was criticized as being a recycled version of the Speckled Ban.
Oh, really? Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really interesting. The Six Thatchers is kind of harkening back to like the recycled case. Like, you have the same case, but it's different.
Speaking of recycling, which is what I didn't think of in too much detail, I think I might have thought of this before, but in the essay, he mentions the five orange pips. I think that's what it's called. And he talks about that one as like one of the listed examples as like people point to this one as being fake or this one being real. And he's like, well, this one's probably real or whatever because, or this is the real Holmes because in this one, mm-hmm. he says that he, I don't remember the exact details. I don't know if it's he didn't eat on a case or he did or he, or no, I think in that story, he's just like, he would forget to eat and there's just forgetfulness and not, like he intentionally would eat. So people would point to characterization differences. And I think it's interesting because that is a big part of the characterization. It's an example of characterization that goes, I think it's brought up in the show. And then like, what is the real Sherlock Holmes? Like, is he really doing this to be this way? Or why is he, you know, why does he do certain things? Or is he just say that he just doesn't eat on case, but he just forgets like the reasons why he gives could be different. Yeah, but that's just one random example, but I thought like, wow, that's the five orange pips. They used that in the episode called The Great Game.
They also use it in The Abominable Bride.
Yes, exactly. Which is another point that I came to, I thought of, remembered it, because the recycled cases where the show points will recycle something or the stories would recycle something. And then they literally did that in series four. But I think that just really goes to show that, but I think that The Abominable Bride is just another example of why The Abominable Bride is we didn't know, we thought it was mostly a one-off episode, but in hindsight it foreshadowed a lot of things and primed the audience for certain things. And us looking back on it, we can see that there are a lot of things in the episode that they were motifs in series four, but also they recycled an episode. It wasn't in the real life, quote unquote, of the story, because I think the form of that episode, you're more willing to accept it. Of course he's recycling a case. They're telling us that they're talking about, and the Moriarty case is sort of being recycled in a way, and like how he died sort of with the bride. Yeah. I can't remember what it was.
Yeah. There's even a line in it where like, I think Moriarty's like, doesn't this sound familiar?
Yeah. This all happened before. Yeah.
Haven't you done this before?
Yes. And then of course they use the five orange pips. Because, it ties into Moriarty, but that's a more obvious example other than Moriarty and the bride, which you can kind of explain away. But the five orange pips is a very specific kind of random detail. And I did notice, like, well, why are they using that in the episode called The Great Game? They have – that's, like, the main thing of that episode for the most part, besides – the Bruce Partington plans that they mentioned throughout the episode, but that's not the focus. That's not the focal point. And then they reused that.
But the Bruce Partington plans, wasn't that the fifth pip?
No, I think he assumed it was because he brought the USB with him.
I think it was the fifth pip.
Oh, he had to solve, right? Yes. He had to solve. Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was it the fifth pip? That was the thing that brought him to Moriarty. That was the final thing. And it was there the entire time.
He's ignoring it.
It was this case that was always there and he was ignoring, but it was the fifth pip.
So I think it's just interesting that they recycle the five orange pips. And I haven't read that story, I don't think. There is an interesting ties into The Abominable Bride there as well. But I don't know, it's just an interesting tidbit. It's kind of that is set up for us. All right, I think that is mostly it. But it's hard to really look at that essay of the Sherlockian game like as where they're getting it from. So we can't really, I don't think we can look at that and say, well, the stories are real or fake here. Mm-hmm. So the show is real or fake here as well. I don't think it's necessarily analogous. I think it's just a concept that we're really looking for here. So we don't have to go into details of what they talk about because that's getting into canon discussion. And especially since there is an element of the final problem where the original story where Doyle possibly wrote it to kill off the character because he was sick of it or he for whatever reason and so that's why it happened, and so certain things had to be changed. So that's impossible to ignore. And I think the circumstances are just different because they didn't do the final problem super late. They did it the Reichenbach fall and then did that earlier and then used the name the final problem again later. So I think that's more telling than the fact that mm-hmm. they're using that. And so we're just meant to look at things as what is real and fake rather than trying to align it exactly.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to, like, mention, I guess, as I know a lot of people, like, again, they like to be like, you're just saying it's fake. Like, that's dumb.
Yeah.
The thing is, we're not really saying it's fake. Like, it's obviously, like, a real season. It's a real season. It's just, like...
And I wouldn't even say that it's all fake. You know? It's not fake.
Exactly. No, yeah. And there's something I think I want to get into at one point, and maybe not now. But I think if we're going to prime it, like the idea, it's something that I've sort of mm-hmm. thought about a little bit more. And I think this ties into my like sort of priming of understanding the entire show as a whole and series four specifically is that it's metafiction. And something that a connection that I found is that there is a connection between metafiction and the play within a play. And I even like looked up, I did a little bit of extra research. So the play within a play is an old tradition dating back to the Renaissance, back to Shakespeare. And it was like one of the earliest examples of metafiction.
And Shakespeare is referenced in series four multiple times, which I was going to bring this up at some point, which is actually funny enough, is something that they talk about in the essay. Where it's like, oh, all of a sudden he just starts quoting Shakespeare, even though he never supposedly didn't know anything about literature. Now he's quoting Shakespeare. So it's just another, like, but anyway, I don't think he quotes. I mean, I know there's the obvious, like, the game is afoot idea, right? That comes from Henry V, I believe. But then... But they don't. He doesn't quote Shakespeare really in the show, I don't think, until series.
He does in series four.
He does in series four, but before that, he doesn't. He's two. He has two. He's got the one in The Six Thatchers.
By the prickling of my thumbs, is that?
Yes. Is that so a... most yeah. people wouldn't think necessarily because it's so common, but I think it because of what we see in. The Lying Detective, that it makes you connect it to Shakespeare. So if you know anything about Shakespeare, you know, because it's Macbeth by the pricking of my thumb, something wicked this way comes from Macbeth. And so that's a little hint at it, but it's also the more obvious, like the game is afoot quote comes in mm-hmm. only in The Lying Detective, where he goes and gives the entire monologue and it's never explained. Like he just
yeah
does
it's just
it.
Like this kind of like, oh, that's kind of cool that he just like recites like Hamlet.
And I love or Henry the it's actually Henry no it's Henry the Fifth.
It's Henry yes. the Fifth.
Yes, Henry the Fifth.
Okay, yeah. And
I read Henry the Fifth in college.
No, my Shakespeare.
I'm not an expert either, but I took a couple Shakespeare classes in college, and so I get very nerdy about this stuff. So yeah, the first one was Macbeth. Hamlet isn't referenced as far as I know, although there is some stabbing in that one, and there's ghosts. But there's also some ghosts and killing in Macbeth too, so it's kind of easy to confuse the two. But
and there's the potential like sonnet references.
Oh, of so, course, yeah. But that's more like subtle hints where it's not like literally him quoting Shakespeare, which is really obvious that he's quoting Shakespeare.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah, that wouldn't count if that was all there was.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's not really until The Lying Detective where he gives a huge monologue, which I love. I took a class where we read all of the main history. So we did Richard II, Henry IV, part 1 and 2, and then read it Henry V. So, and that was during the 2016 election, too. So that was fun. So many connections. Oh, that was so fun.
That was a time.
It was a time, but that was a really fun class though, too. But I was so excited when I heard him giving that monologue. So I didn't really think of anything of it at the time, but in hindsight, it is kind of random that he can make the game is afoot reference without having to do the whole speech. So it's really entertaining. Anyway, I wouldn't put too much weight on that necessarily, though. It's just one, some fun thing that we're talking about right now. But let's talk about the actual final problem, because the story in canon is one thing, and then in the show, it's treated in a slightly different, it has more weight to what the final problem is as a concept. In the mm-hmm. story, it's really just, it's more literal. Like, this is the final, quote unquote, final conflict and crime and antagonist, and so the final case, and so he dies, quote unquote. Spoilers, he doesn't. he doesn't die, but it was supposed to be, so, and that's really all it was, as far as I know. Of course, there's some historical perspective that we can give to it, where Doyle, some people theorize, like, well, Doyle maybe did it because this, he had to give him this ultimate villain that he had to defeat, and he had to end it altogether in order to not have to continue the facade or the lie, if he was indeed trying to put in a little bit of subtext. But because it was dangerous back then to put too much obvious subtext, and I don't think people really realize that, is that even like, well, I guess Oscar Wilde, how obvious he was is mm-hmm. up for debate, but they read aloud his works in court. So it wasn't completely unquestionable that they could use something as blackmail or pull what they wanted to point to something. It wasn't like it's subtext, so no one would have seen it. So it was still possible. But they would have to intentionally make things very vague and hidden so that you wouldn't look too closely. And it's possible that he just was sick of that, and also kind of the looking over your shoulder type feeling to it, which when I read it on the plane the other day, I was on a plane and I was reading the final problem, and it struck me something that I didn't take from the show. I didn't see this really. I mean, it's there, but it wasn't as evident to me because it wasn't put in so many words. Whereas in the story, the original story, Watson writes about how Sherlock is like constantly like he's anxious, he's looking over his shoulder, he feels like something's following, he knows someone's following him, so mm-hmm. he's just constantly yeah. anxious and doesn't want to live his life that way, he just wants to get rid of this guy. And so I think the stories themselves are, quote, killed off because he can't be looking over his shoulder, and also the character can't be looking over his shoulder constantly. He's shaky and nervous because there's always this looming presence. Yeah. Have you read it or has not?
I haven't read it. No. I should read it, but that's crazy. Yeah. Every time I read any Sherlock Holmes story, I'm like there's always something that just I'm like, I have to scream. Like I have to like, yeah. I read a page and I have to like, just walk away and scream for a bit, and then I come back. It's like, it's not very efficient.
Yeah, I haven't read all of them. I think I will probably make an effort. I think this is a good way to get us to read canon, because I made an effort to read that story because I had nothing else to do. So I will try my best to read more of the stories, because there's always things that we can pull from. Yeah.
I definitely read a lot of, or a bit of The Valley of Fear, which is a insane story that mm-hmm. has a lot.
We will definitely touch on it. Yeah. I have to read that one. I have to read that one. I promise. Before we get to series 4, I will read it. But then so the final problem is really just a concept externally to the story itself mm-hmm. in a more significant way. Whereas in the story, it's simple, but outside of the story, it's more complex. But in the mm-hmm. show, they have more time. And so they really take the final problem, the idea of the final problem, and they introduce it the first time we meet Moriarty in what other episode except The Great Game, which is an interesting concept. So a lot of people, I think there's always such a disagreement. I mean, there's the number one, like, misunderstanding or misconception or mystery, I guess, is, how did Sherlock survive the fall? people still think that's a question, which I get it, but it's really not.
I don't think
a
it question. Matters.
But it doesn't matter even really, yeah, either. But then there's also the idea of what the final problem is. People tend to favor one idea or another, and that's the idea that the final problem is staying alive, which it is. And then there's also the idea that he says the reason why he's doing what he's doing in The Great Game is he tells Sherlock that he wants to burn him or burn the heart out of him. And so some people kind of look at both of those as separate or kind of the same. And I never really understood how to interpret what the final problem really is, supposedly.
I think that they are kind of one and the same.
Me too.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, in both instances, he says the final problem and then leads that up with burn the heart out of you, or the final problem is staying alive.
Yeah.
So I think that this idea is about destroying and or preserving the myth of Sherlock Holmes. And the myth of Sherlock Holmes.
And there's levels to it. Like there's the in-story reason, and that's literally killing him and staying alive. And then there's also the heart of him, where you are not alive because your heart's not working or beating. And then there's the more emotional alive idea of if you have a heart, you are alive as a human being. You have life as a broad concept, not in a literal sense.
Yeah, or you have the ability to love, or the ability to like
feel that feeling alive. And then there's which Moriarty, it's implied he can't really, because he doesn't really have a heart. And that's what is the difference between those two characters, despite the way that Sherlock likes to pretend otherwise before that. But then there's also a higher level that we're looking at here too. And I don't think I fully understood that level until recently. We know that the last episode of series 4 is the final problem. And so there's a reason why. And so you can interpret it as the whole series or the whole episode is a problem, and it points to burning the heart. Well, what's the heart? And that's kind of the emotional aspect, and also how we view series 4 goes into John himself is like the number one example of the figurative heart of Sherlock, because he feels emotions for people that he cares about. And so that's the number one example. And so clearly something's wrong there. That's a problem. And there is a danger of the heart being burnt out of him. And so I think a lot of us took that as maybe this was like a long game, and really the good final goal is not to just kill Sherlock or kill everyone else, but it's more actually the long game would be killing off the people that he cares about in order to burn the heart out of him, which is the more insidious, the more real way to get at him than just killing him, which wouldn't be kind of like, who cares, which is what he says. But then why would he stay alive? That kind of connects to it. But it wasn't really until recently that I thought about it in a different way, because I connected it to an even broader perspective where of the, as we were saying, like the myth of Sherlock Holmes, who he is, because who he is connected to, well, is this guy a machine without a heart, a brain without a heart, or is there more to him? And so who he really is always the mystery. And so who he is as the facade is the myth that people are constantly debating, but people assume is him. Like they feed into the idea that he is a machine without feelings. And that's the myth. There's so many other things that go into that, but there's the myth of Sherlock Holmes that they have to kill off, because you see in The Reichenbach Fall sets it up where he has to appear to die, and his public image has to die.
That's like the biggest point of it. It's like not that he died, it's that his public image has been destroyed.
Yes.
That his reputation.
And then he has to seem like he has died by killing himself, essentially. But which is different to the original story where he did it in a way to kill Moriarty, whereas in the show, he'd already died. So it changes the perspective. He didn't just do it to kill Moriarty. He didn't do it at all. He did it to save people rather than to stop Moriarty directly. As it is in the story, he does it to save other people, which is it's there in the original story, but it's not, it's more obvious in the show. And then when they bring it back in The Final Problem, it really doesn't have anything, I don't think, to do with The Final Problem, the story. No. They just named it The Final Problem to give it an element of like, well, Moriarty is supposedly back, so we have to do that. And then also it's supposed to seem like it's the end.
Yeah, and it does the opposite of what the Reichenbach Fall does. Because the Reichenbach Fall, it kills them off, but it also destroys the myth of Sherlock Holmes. But what the end of The Final Problem does is it preserves it. Because they end it by saying that who he really is doesn't matter. That it's only about the adventurers.
Yeah. And then we have to connect it. This is where I had like a moment of like mind exploding, because I connected it to that one story it's a very popular story and people always reference it. And that's the poem by Vincent Starrett, I believe, about Sherlock Holmes. And we always quote that one as it is always 1895. As a reference to Oscar Wilde, that year is an important year, but which is true in some respects, but it's not the only way that it can be important. And I didn't like think of it in any other way. I think a lot of people look at the end of that poem as being very, it's sentimental and it means a lot, because it's like, well, they're always around, and it's a beautiful idea that they're never gonna die. They're always there.
But yeah, what we're really saying is that they'll never change. That like it's about preserving the myth.
Exactly. And then the quote of in the poem, it says like, though the world explode, these two survive, and it is always 1895. And I didn't really it put things into perspective of like that exploding. I think a lot of people looked at the promo for series 4 and saw that it was sort of shaped like a heart and it was all exploding, and like 221B explodes literally, but they survive and everything is like boop and it's fine, which is metaphor there on its own. But also them being alive, well of course they're gonna be alive, right? But there's also the point that Moriarty points out, which I never took much meaning to it, I never understood that, where he goes like, so boring, isn't it, just staying. Like he doesn't want to be alive because it's boring. Nothing is different. It's just the same. And I just took that as, well, he's just crazy, I guess. He has no reason. He has no joy out of life. So of course he would say that. But looking at it from an external perspective, a meta fiction perspective, it has a different weight when I look at it that way. I'm like, oh my goodness. Of course, like the final problem is burning the heart out of him, because if he stays alive, it's just staying the same. There's no change. And that burns the heart out of him, regardless of if he's still alive and if 221B is still preserved. There has to be an element of death of the image.
Because the myth is that he doesn't have a heart.
Yes.
So that is burning the heart out of him by keeping him alive.
Exactly. And then having everything be the same. Just like the stories. The silly detective and the funny hat or whatever the line is. Yeah. So, and I think it's even more telling that we have this speech that Mary, of all people, gives.
Oh, I love that. And I love it so much.
I know. And then it's like this looming like narrator, because it's not John, which the only time.
The narrator.
Which, well, sort of, right?
No, in that sense. And that's what I love about it. Because everything that Mary represents, and maybe we could talk about this in the next episode.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole thing about Mary and what she represents, and I think it's so cool. But to have her be the one to say it, it says so much, because I don't know if I should say it, like, because she sort of represents like like heteronormativity. She's like sort of like, and like homophobia, and she's like the one that's saying it.
Yes.
And there's this there's this quote,
because it goes back to the original stories too. Like they had, she had to give her a wife, give him a wife. Sorry, give John, like the narrator, a story, or in the story, give him a wife on paper. Absolutely. And that was, I think that was the first one he wrote, right? It wasn't the first published, but it was the first one he wrote. So it's very telling.
Really?
Yeah. I don't think it was the first published, but I think this, as the story goes, he wrote it at the same time he wrote it at the same time as like when him and Oscar Wilde.
I know
Wilde
he wrote it with Oscar Wilde at the same time as Richard Dorian Gray.
Yeah, but I don't think that it was. I believe it was the first. I'll have to double check this, but I'm pretty sure it was the first one he wrote. But it's not the first one he published for sure. Hmm. Because then A Study in Scarlet is when they first met. So it goes back in time before he would have had a wife. So
there's this quote from Stephen Moffat that I really love when he talks about like that specific monologue at the end with Mary. And this is what he says. He says, "Also, this is not an element that is in the original story, but it is in our version. It is her legacy that they then live. It's her saying, this is who you have to be. You have to go and consciously be Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. Sherlock Holmes will now wear the silly hat because Mary liked it. It just felt right." I love that. And everyone is so mad about it. And that's what's so great about it.
Yes. Of course he does, because it feels right. She likes it. Because to most people, it is right. That is the character, right? But it's what we're trying to do in looking at the original stories. What is the real story? What is Watson, the narrator, obscuring? And also, who is Sherlock Holmes? That's the ultimate question, is what is the real story? Who really is this character? And it goes to, I think even Knox said it himself. Let me find the quote. I think it's at the beginning. Any studies in Sherlock Holmes must be first and foremost studies in Dr. Watson, which of course, because he's the one telling the story and he's the narrator. But interestingly enough, the show isn't his narration. We see him typing the blog, and we know that there is a story that's being told, but we don't see what's in the blog because that's very limited information. And some things, you'll see some inconsistencies there. Or things that have his perspective on him, but we see the more objectively what is the real story. And we don't ever get his narration until The Abominable Bride, because that's just separate. It's not supposed to be real in an explicit way. We know by the end it's not real in our in-universe show. Yes. And then in series 4, he's not the narrator, but there's certain elements that they invoke that idea. And then also the blog stops working. And there's a lot that we can get into about that, but there's a lot of narration, unreliability, where I don't think it's fake. And I think a lot of us we kind of walked back what we said in the early days where, yeah, it's fake, but it's not really fake necessarily. Mm-hmm. We don't really know how much of it is real. We can point to moments that we think are probably real, but are just heavily edited. But we don't necessarily think that, or they're recycled things. But there is a true story in there. We just can't 100% say what it is, because there are certain things that we just aren't being told. But we can glean what it might be. And that's kind of the point, is that we're playing the game. We are looking at what we know about the characters to be true, and then looking at what we're given in the stories that we think are quote unquote fake or not entirely real, or that we're being lied to about, and we're trying to figure out what it actually is. And there's multiple levels to that. There's a, what are they trying to say about the characters, which we already kind of know anyway, but then there's the element of what's the true story being told, which I don't think we will really figure out what it actually is definitively until series 5, but we can try and have fun with it.
Exactly.
And that's the point. All right. Let's see. I think there was something else I wanted to mention. Oh, but I wanted to give a couple quotes about what Mark Gatiss and Stephen Moffat say. The reason why we think that the final problem, even though it feels like a finale, they're upholding the myth of Sherlock Holmes as a figure, as a character. But going back to an interview way back in the day, when they did the first season, I believe, this is like right after the first season, they had an interview where they talked about why they're modernizing the character and why they're doing an adaptation in the first place. And their perspective on it was, and I quote, "We've got it in our heads. This comes from a place of us being fans. This wasn't a case of let's grab that off the shelf and update it. It was, we love this. We think everybody's been getting it wrong, and we think we can get it right. Unless you think you're correcting everyone else, you shouldn't be doing something. You should be saying, now this is the way it should be done." And if you take them at their word, which I don't think there's any reason for them to lie, but if you take them at their word, there's no reason why he should be ending the final problem the way that they do. Because if you're saying, like, if that's the end for real, then you have to look back at what they intended and say, okay, if that's really what you were trying to do, what are you correcting? I think you can point to some small things, but really at the end of the final problem, he is the same character as they were, you know, in the Sign of Three or in, you know, the Empty Hearse or whatever, and take any other canon story and put it on screen and change nothing else and allude to nothing else, and you could keep the stories the same and it would be basically the same character and there would have been no growth. And so it can't be the end because there's no growth in the character. And a five act story has to have some sort of change. And we'll get into a lot of that. We do think that the show follows a five-act structure, but there has to be a question of, okay, if they really think that they were modernizing it for a reason to have an argument, there's a thesis about the character and the characters, what is it? Because the final problem doesn't really offer anything new to the table.
No. I mean, and I think it's really also very interesting. I mean, the show does present a character that does change and grow, but then it ends with him not changing.
Yeah.
It ends with this monologue saying that, no, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter that you've changed. Like, it only matters what people think about you. Mm-hmm. And so it, like, just negates everything that just happened. You know, there's even a moment in The Lying Detective where, like, when John is at the flat and, Mrs. Hudson says something about, like, you know, like, Sherlock's not about thinking, he's about feeling.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's like they're presenting the story where, like, it matters, but then it ends
at the very last moment. Nope. Nah, never mind.
Nah. Forget that.
Forget it. Forget everything we just said. And then they're negating everything. So it's like, why go through all that effort? And just to turn around and say, nope, never mind.
Yeah, no, we really, yeah, I think something I think that Mark and Stephen have said is that, well, the goal of series 4 was to bring them to the point of Rathbone, which again, that's like, you know, even like the little freeze frame where it's at Rathbone's face.
Yes, oh my god, that's perfect. I forgot about that. Yeah. Which that whole frame in general is like that staying. They are literally frozen in time or in this picture-perfect perspective where they're always – we could replay that moment and pick up right where we left off and nothing would change or have changed or would change necessarily or would have to. And I was reading through – we don't have to go into detail about John York, but I was reading through his book the other day and he talked about – that's like kind of his whole criticism of certain – television, or in, now it's in more movies, more films, where the characters don't really change. And it's like that, and it connects it to Bond. Like, well, Bond doesn't change. He, a character can have a motive and can want something, but they're, and they accomplish the goal by the end of the story, but they don't change. They can't change, because if they do change, then they cease to be what we want them to be, and we can't keep them going forever. The only way that a story can end is if there is a change. And if we want Sherlock Holmes stories to continue as they always have been, they have to keep going. And people don't want that. I mean, you can keep the story going, but they don't want him to change. And so they keep the same regurgitated stories. They repeat old cases and the same stories and the same ideas and the same questions without ever answering them.
You know, I think that also ties back again to like this idea that if you bring it back to Rathbone, they're bringing it back to a sort of format of Sherlock Holmes where they can just continue to make stories that are like in a vacuum. And I think it fits with them saying that and also them being like, seems like it's over, but maybe we'll do a special. And maybe we'll just keep going back, you know, just like the Rathbone series, we'll just keep going back. And it just like continues with that narrative. And they do that a lot at the end of series. Like, they continue with the narrative.
And I think they will. I think they will do those. And I think that's going to be what people are going to see eventually, is that at the end of series 4 or 5, there will be, hopefully, a definitive end. There'll be fulfillment, emotional, romantic entanglement, fulfilling him as a human being. I'm sorry. And then that will be, I know, there will be a conclusion to a story, but it's not all the stories. But he's still changing. And I think it's just what is the true character and who he is, and answering that question, having his character grow. And then I think we will then arrive to that place of, it can just be his character. He always was that character, but we're just changing the way that we're talking about him. And I think it will arrive to that place where that Mark Gatiss has alluded to before, where you can have a detective who is a maverick, which actually, funny enough, John York mentions that exact word in his book, in the introduction. He says, like, why are all policemen or police officers mavericks? I was like, oh, that's interesting. And it's because they can't really change. But he, like, Mark Gatiss has this, had this idea where he talked about a detective who was a maverick and his work. And he comes home and his boyfriend asks, are you okay? And it's just, it is what it is. But they can still tell those stories while also having who he really is changed as the character, the idea of the character, not necessarily, it's just one chapter that's closed and ended. And I think that's what they're trying to do. And they can still do specials and have a contained story with growth. And I think that's the one thing that people don't want to do with the character, because that means changing the way that they view the character. But we do that all the time in stories, in series, and we'll do like a sequel series or a new season or a new reboot of something or whatever, where the character's still going through a change and they end it in a satisfying way. But that doesn't mean there isn't more stories to tell. You know?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah, but I do know what you mean. So like, they're not going to do specials at this point.
That would be no. Stupid. That would just be wrong.
It would be wrong. They have to. It would be so unsatisfying. And to some people, it is satisfying. But to a lot of people that are looking at all the questions that they raised in series 4, even that they never answered by the end, we are literally dangling on the precipice. Gary Depps is dangling from a cliff.
Yes.
Right in front of us.
Literally.
Literally. Oh. Because they point in the, and it's like perfect because they point to that moment as like the pivotal not moment. Even just in a John Locke perspective, but it's the most important moment for them, but also just the right. And it's the character of Sherlock Holmes too, where we see the great heart. Like, you can't not have that moment. You have to have that moment in some way to thematically show the great heart of him and they need that moment in order for what we're talking about to come to a conclusive end, for there to be growth in terms of the character in the show, but also who the character is as the as an iconic figure.
Yeah, and I think also more importantly, I think the Garadib moment is there for John to see it. Because I think to a degree, yes. We as an audience have seen
well, he's a storyteller too,
yeah.
Right?
He is the storyteller, he's the author.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not so much for us, the audience, but more like John and us as a wider audience, because John is us.
Mm-hmm.
In a wider sense, like we're the audience.
Yeah, we're like the viewer and he's the author. Yeah, there's like there's a whole thing. I feel like there's like a whole thing with like eyeballs in Sherlock, yes, as well, where they show a lot of eyes. Ooh, and it's, yes, like John, everything is through John's, mm-hmm, eye. But there's also, yep, like a tie with him and Arthur Conan Doyle. So I don't know, mm-hmm, there's a lot. There's a lot there.
Yeah, and that's actually another something else that they mentioned in John Yorick's book too. He talks about it as the character is us. So, but yeah, I think the one piece of trivia is the, what is his name? The set, this designer.
What's Arwell?
Arwell. I think he mentioned, right, on Twitter that he made the iconic skull as like with the eyes of Doyle, and it, mm-hmm, I think is it the words of A Study in Scarlet?
It's the entirety of A, yes, Study in Scarlet,
which is so meta, but it's also the idea of the artist observing himself, literally like the story, like they inserted the original creator, but also there's an analogy to John and Doyle in general. But he's the author of what we're seeing. We're seeing it through his perspective, whether it's literally him typing up the story and republishing it or putting it out there, and we're just seeing a reenactment of it, or we're just seeing it as he saw it in general. But he's the unreliable narrator, and I think that's not a difficult concept to wrap your brain around. It's really not. We know unreliable narrators all the time. And another example that I want to mention is The Great Gatsby, because Nick Carraway, the whole story is his perspective. He's writing the story. He's talking to us as he's writing it. And it's pretty common, like a pretty widely accepted interpretation of that story and that character as him being an unreliable narrator. Because at the beginning he says he's trying to prove to the reader that he's trustworthy and honest, and that, mm-hmm, is like you're reading him in between the lines, and then in this one they tell you that they're lying or hiding information.
Like
literally, and well, in the stories, he's literally telling you that I'm withholding information.
Yeah, he's like, I'm gonna lie.
I'm not gonna tell you something. Sorry. Oh well, and then you can't just take it as straight. But in the show, they do the same thing, because in the beginning of series four, literally the first scene is us rewatching what we saw in His Last Vow, and it's different now. And they tell us that's not what happened. Well, it is now. They tell us that that's this idea that they pose to the audience immediately at the beginning of the story, which is exactly what Doyle would have done. Had Watson write the story saying, things are different now, but this is the story that I'm telling you. And this is how I'm saying it's going.
Yeah, and I love like the comparison of having the very beginning of series four sort of, mm-hmm, acting as that moment where Watson's like, I'm about to lie to you about some things.
I'm about to tell you a porky.
It's this way of them saying, we're about to like lie to you about some things. Some things, yes, didn't actually happen the way that, mm-hmm, they are about to be presented. That it's doctored footage.
Doctored, I was just gonna say doctored, yeah, footage, which is so good. It's just a very specific word choice. They didn't have to use that.
But they're so good with the word choices too. I love how specific they are.
That's like one of Gatiss' strengths, I think, is, mm-hmm, really getting that one line that just hits in so many ways.
Very clever use of language and wording.
Oh man, which is it's fun. I eventually we're gonna have to talk about that episode. Oh, because but that's like the one I hate the most. Not literally hate it, but I can't watch it. It's
It's
hard.
hard to watch. It's really hard to watch.
I love what it does, but it's not a rewatchable episode without a maybe, who knows? Maybe one day when I've seen the whole of series five and I'm satisfied, it will make it easier. And who knows, I could have a totally different experience. But right now it's just like, it's painful. But it's like a, and it's a different, because it's too, it's just real enough because it's the first time that you're like, whoa, something is off. And we all said that at the when the episode came out.
It's so uncomfortable. Yeah, you're just like, something is weird about this, and I don't know what it is. But there's a lot in the Six Thatchers that's really great. A lot of like really cool. And I remember noticing this too at first, and I didn't know what to make of it. But like, all, like a lot of the text on the screen that they have in the beginning montage when they're solving cases, and they're all about like paint to cover up another smell, and like there's like all this like really neat sort of stuff in the background. And then, of course, my one of my favorite moments is the moment with Charlie, the boy in the car with the Power Ranger. God, it's so it that part always just hits me and makes me very sad.
And then there's the less sad, but also like my brain is exploding when you like think about the ridiculous death scene of for Mary when she
Oh
gets
my
shot, and you're like, this
God.
is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. And if you've watched, if you literally watch back to back His Last Vow, watch the end, and then skip to that scene, you would immediately go, whoa, that's exactly what they said not to do. So it's not just weird, it's not just like badly written, because we know, and it's not just like, oh, they forgot the rules that they set out and they're just doing what they want, because they are doing to a T what they said not to do. The situation is exactly the same, but it's impossible, and they break every single rule perfectly in a really obvious way, and then some.
Yeah,
But
it's making me think of the Rachel Talalay thing with the her blog post where she's just like, here are some rules on how to not direct your actors. I decided to do the opposite. Like, okay.
And I love that she doesn't, I don't know how much she knows. I think she never even watched the final problem or never read the script. She had the option and she decided not to. And that really
She
just,
knows something.
that she knows, I'm sure she knows something, but she doesn't actually see what's going to happen in the future. And so we don't really know for sure. We don't really know for sure how much she knew and didn't know, but
I think
regardless,
she knows how she was directing, like supposed to direct it. Especially since she made that comment.
she said it in the article or in the essay that she wanted to recreate the way that she felt when she read the script. So much of it comes from the script. And so she's just recreating, and that's why she took a different direction with it, because she wanted to recreate it. And the only way to do that was to, the only way to do that was to recreate how she felt, and that was to break certain rules by telling them, this is how we're supposed to feel when we watch the scene. So they're intentionally acting a certain way.
Yeah, I feel like they had to have given her some direction. We wanted, they probably didn't tell her everything, but they're probably like, we want to do something kind of Brechtian. I feel like she has,
They could have totally told her that,
because she made that comment about she's just a pawn in this theater of the absurd. Why else would she make that comment?
I think that's definitely a possibility, a very strong possibility. It could, and it could fit with everything else that she said too, and it wouldn't really change anything. So, without getting too much into series four, or I think we'll probably inevitably bring it back up. I don't know how much we want to go into series four and what we think about it, and beyond the Great Game, the things that we've just been alluding to, like Brecht or Chekhov or absurdism. There's so many things that we'll be trying to explain, but I think we'll just mention them here and there. But I don't think we really are going to go into too much detail until maybe before we talk about series four. Sound like a good idea? We can kind of play by ear, but.
I mean, I kind of feel like in order to talk about series four, you have to know about these things.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like, I feel like it's sort of a primer for like understanding like why would they do this? Like,
I think we would bore
how do
people
you
if we did it
know?
before like series one and two or three. Yeah.
Oh yeah, of course. But like before we do
For
series four, for
sure,
sure.
because you have to have that background before you re-examine it. Otherwise, you're just gonna keep seeing it the same way. So we're definitely gonna go into that. I think we've really given our thesis as to our view of the show and what series four is doing, and that's at its most basic analysis. It is giving us an unreliable story that we have to look at and try to really see what's being told to us by playing the game. And there are so many references to why we think that they're doing that in series four itself, and I'm sure we will probably get to that. So you just have to take our word for it. And then we'll eventually talk more about it. But yes, and then we are doing that to try to figure out who Sherlock is as a character, and that's what they're really trying to get us to re-examine with series four. And then I think the John Lockean element to it is like an added bonus. It's like it's at the heart of it, and it's really the why, because otherwise it's just like, okay, why don't you just retell the story and tell us who he is rather than they're really it's all tied into each other, and so you can't really do one without the other. And so that's part of our theory, but I think you could probably still get something out of what we're saying, even if you don't buy into the element. But we will still be talking about that a lot and why we think that that's at the literal heart of the show, beyond Sherlock's character, because it points to why, even in the original stories, why was there a question as to if he had emotions or not. And why it was something that had to be hidden potentially. That's how a lot of people interpret the original stories, and that's why we're still questioning it today. So we have to get to that before we can figure out why there is a myth of who his character is. So, my idea for our next episode, we're going to talk about. I can't read all of canon in a week, but I think we can maybe highlight some key moments from the original stories to give some people some perspective on those, and then talk about the subtext of that and the context so we can go into some historical context and why are they doing all of this to begin with. So we can talk a little bit of homosexuality in the Victorian era and the way that writers, authors, creators at the time even would get around having to say it explicitly. And we'll probably talk about Teaplash, which is a film from the 70s that was a big inspiration for Mark Gatiss. We'll talk a little bit about that, and then we will go into like the background information on all of those things and how this informed the writers and going into BBC Sherlock, this show itself. I figure the next episode we will go into a little bit of the canon and like the subtext and our viewing of that because that informs the way that we view the show itself as well as how we think we the
I have
writers are
some
doing it
guests.
as well. Even though we won't like read the whole canon, but we're not experts in it. But who knows? I think in a future episode we might even do some further analysis to get into the stuff that we aren't able to pick up on because I'm not an expert on that for by any means. But yeah, so we'll just cover the basics though and what we know and what's really necessary to know. But I'm sure there's always going to be more to it beyond what we are going to say. But and then we'll talk a little bit more of like the historical context of the Victorian era because that informs the way that they the way that the stories were written and the way that the shows, the language that the show is working with as well. And that relates to the film, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, which we know that is a really important, it's the film that changed Mark Gatiss' life, and that is using his own wording. So big influence and on both of them, not even just Mark. So
it's their favorite film. Yes. It's their favorite film of all time, yes. In fact, both of them.
So we'll talk a little bit about that. I think we're definitely going to, go into more detail on that as we inevitably make comparisons to Scandal, but we can give like the lowdown on that episode and how. So just to give some historical context, background for the writers as well, and how they went into making the show. And then we can use that as an opportunity to talk about BBC and how they got the show first started. And then we can talk about the unaired pilot, which is a lot of fun.
Yes. Oh, I'm excited for that.
I can't wait. I'm really excited. I'm probably going to watch it sometime in the next couple of days because it's so good.
I know. So, it's so cheesy, though.
It is, but in a good way.
Yes, absolutely.
It'll be so much fun. And we do have a guest in the plan for that, so we'll have to give ourselves a deadline and when we're going to record, and hopefully, unless something changes, we'll bring someone in to chat about it so it's not just us. This was a very long episode. It's like almost 2 hours long.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
We had a lot to cover.
Yeah, this is like the initial pilot, so I think it makes sense for this to be like the longest episode, and then we can...
Yeah, which, who knows, we could totally make another one longer, but we put a lot of effort and homework into this because there's just a lot to put at the front of it. Mm-hmm. And then in the future, we'll do probably a little bit less for the next one. And then in the future, we're just going to go through all of the episodes, one after the other in order, and break down each scene and talk about what the episode is doing thematically for the characters, for the whole show as a whole. And we'll just we'll just chat about what we already basically do anyway.
Yes, exactly.
And then try to present it in a way that it's accessible to those that are listening that maybe are not the initiated. So if you listen to all of that, and you are not at all initiated, sorry that it was so long, but thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, we will probably are you willing to do that? Leave the links to where they can find it?
Yes, absolutely.
And I believe I have made one for this podcast. I haven't done anything with it. It's just kind of sitting there, but I will also leave a link to that one. And there you will find links to our blogs. You can find us and ask any questions if you have any things that maybe we need to clarify, or ideas for topics you might want us to touch on, which we might not do a whole episode on them, but we might bring it up in an episode, or who knows, way down the line.
Maybe we'll have like a little Q&A section or something.
All right. And then if any of our friends, we'll probably be talking to them about whether or not they want to guest on a particular episode. I already have someone in mind for Tab and a Scandal. Yeah. I already know someone who wants to do that. So it'll be so much fun. And yeah, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.